Coming up on Boston Public Radio, CNN's John King starts us off with Karl Rove playing doctor with Hillary Clinton, Mitt Romney embracing the minimum wage, and whether there will be negotiations with terrorists in Nigeria. Then back home, say goodbye to the best turkey hash on the planet as Charlie's Sandwich Shop shuts its doors. Will you miss it? What Boston institution do you miss? And then the man behind tonight's frontline, the United States of Secrets. Michael Kirk joins us to talk about the real story of NSA surveillance and its victims.
We'll take your calls on what we just heard about the government's crackdown on those longtime patriots and NSA spying. Then Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School. She weighs in on the new book by ex-Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, an architect of the financial bailout. All that's coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Brady, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
I'm skipping the weather report today. It's too depressing. I'm just going to ignore the whole
okay,
thing.
Okay, Jim. Go right ahead.
GOP operative Karl Rove is saying that Hillary Clinton has brain damage from her fall last year. Meanwhile, Mitt Romney is arguing for a federal minimum wage hike. What's to make of two Republican leading men taking on two completely different priorities? Joining us to make sense of these and other national headlines is CNN's chief national correspondent. He's also host of Inside Politics Sunday morning on CNN. Hello there, John King.
How about this one? Good Tuesday. Can I try it this way? One's trying to stir up a legitimate policy conversation, and the other one is doing something very completely different and perhaps reckless.
I would assume the latter refers to Republican strategist Karl Rove talking about Hillary's brain. Well, let's start with that, John King. First of all, she only spent 3 days in the hospital, but not 30 days. But that's what he said, that she spent 30 days in the hospital and she's wearing glasses that are only for people with a traumatic brain injury. What'd you make of this?
Well, he went on Fox News this morning. He said this at a private gathering where he and Robert Gibbs, I think, were paid to give a Q&A presentation. And so he said it last week. It was reported today in the New York Post. And then he went on Fox News and says, oh, no, that's not what I said. What I said was, that if she runs for president, her health is going to be an issue and she's going to have to explain all this. Well, that part's true, but it's classic, right? You plant the seed by saying something that goes way out there. He says he never said that she had brain damage, but that she wears these glasses that people who have traumatic brain injuries wear. So if he didn't say it as harshly as some people have characterized it, okay, but he knew what he was doing here. Number one, Karl Rove doesn't say things by accident. He's a very disciplined guy. Number two, a lot of conservatives do talk about this and raise questions about her health. And guess what? All Americans will be due answers about her health if she runs for president. She would be 69 if she took office, if she runs in 2016. All candidates for president, especially those who are, in their 60s, yes, they have some accountability to release their records or to make their physicians available to us. But the way he said this was not a question that John King or Jim Browdy or Marjorie Egan might raise about Hillary Clinton if she's running for president. Is she fit to serve? It was done in a much more gin up the Republican base, start a conversation, be a little reckless on purpose kind of way.
Well, you mentioned that Karl Rove, all occasionally referred to as Bush's brain, not by me, but it's been written about that way, obviously, W specifically. You mentioned he doesn't do anything unintentionally. So should one assume that a lot of the big money Republicans, and obviously he had PACs that he was running relatively unsuccessfully last presidential election, should we assume that this is what the big money guys want to hear? Is this kind of, you call it reckless. I heard you this morning at 7:30, even more dramatic. I mean, it is foul. It's fine, as you say, to raise issues about anybody's health who wants to lead the free world. But is this what the Adelsons and others want in this campaign?
Well, I think they certainly want to know that everybody's ready to be tough because they know the Clintons are formidable. But I take this more as an effort to not so much please the donors. Number one, Carl, since he's become a super PAC consultant, is a different guy than when he was the architect of the Bush campaign. And look, I say this about James Carville. I'll say it about Karl Rove. You are the chief strategist for two successful presidential campaigns. Then you have earned a special place in American politics because that's hard to do.
Yep.
So respect him as a strategist, whether you like or dislike his politics. But remember on election night in 2012, I think he's still arguing that let's wait a little while.
Mitt Romney might win Florida.
Yeah, I've been waiting and waiting, and I still can't figure out what he was doing there. he's been different since he's been directly asking people for a lot of money himself, as opposed to raising money for candidates. Number one. But number two, I take this as, if you look at what has happened, and we've talked about this in recent weeks on other issues, whether it's the return of Monica Lewinsky, and the Republicans had nothing to do with that, let me be clear, she gave that interview, but Republicans, well, some Republicans made clear it's fair game. If she runs for president, we're going to stir up all of Bill's mess and the circus around the Clintons. Whether it's tough on Benghazi, now tough on Nigeria and Boko Haram, I think part of this is a message to Hillary, and I think it's born of deep concern, if not fear, that they don't have anybody who can beat her, that don't you just want to be a grandmother and enjoy your postpartum life? If you come in as a candidate, we're going to be really rough on you.
Well, John came from CNN. The strategy from some in the Republican camp was basically to almost blame Hillary for the abduction of these 200-plus schoolgirls in Nigeria. That she did, it was her fault because she didn't call them a terrorist organization when she was Secretary of State.
Look, her record in public office, anything she has said or done in public life is fair game. I mean, I'll be clear about that. Now, is she to blame? Of course she's not to blame. Is it a legitimate question? Why didn't you? Look, the Pentagon, the CIA, the Justice Department all wanted to name Boko Haram, the group, a terrorist organization. The State Department said no. It did name a few of the leaders, put them on the terrorist list. Now, their argument was, and there are people who say this argument makes sense, not to elevate them. That if the United States labeled them a terrorist, it was essentially like the gold star in that, you know, in the Islamic extremist world. That so the United States hates us so much they put us on this list, that it would help with their recruiting and help with their fundraising if the United States gave them that notoriety, or to them in that sick world they operate in, that fame. So that's their argument. We should go back and look at that. We should look at whatever documentation is available as to what the debate was. We should talk to the people who were involved about it. They clearly went against the wishes of their own Justice Department, their own CIA, and their own Pentagon. And that is fair game. Just like, what was she doing, you know, in the days and weeks and the months, and why didn't the warnings, if none of the Benghazi warnings ever reached her office, why not? Who was managing that shop? Well, why didn't they kick in the secretary's door and say, ma'am, you need to see this? That is all fair game. But can it be done, whether it's Hillary Clinton or anyone else, and I'm asking it that way because it seems like the Republicans can't do it when it's her, why can't you just do it in a dispassionate, factual way and follow the facts, not follow your black helicopter conspiracy theory?
You know, John, we're going to get back to Nigeria in a second. I just want to stay on Hillary Clinton for a few more minutes. I was trying to read behind the lines with what you said a minute ago. And we know that Rand Paul did raise the Lewinsky thing even before Lewinsky wrote the piece in Vanity Fair. And now we have this brain damage thing. Is part of the thinking that Hillary is such a formidable candidate and maybe an unbeatable candidate, the conventional wisdom may go, that we're going to let her know now how incredibly personal and vicious this campaign is going to be. And so maybe she decides, who was it, Tina Brown the other day said she should move right to her post-presidency was the expression she used. Is that even remotely possible that attacks at this stage would cause someone like Hillary Clinton to decide not to run?
Well, I don't read minds, but I do keep in close touch with Paul Begala, who, you know, worked for James Carville and Paul
sure.
Begala were the team that helped Bill Clinton. And Paul is very close to the Clinton family, and he's very close to Secretary Clinton. And his take on this is that she's so tough and that she's such a competitor that kicking her is only going to convince her to run, not convince mm-hmm. her to not run. That, you know, the more you say, if you do this, you know, we're going to be rough on you, the more she's going to say, great, you know, let's go. I like a good fight. I don't know the answer to that question. You know, she was Secretary of State. She was First Lady for Bill Clinton in a very polarizing time. She was in the Senate. She knows what it's like to be one of the most polarizing figures in American politics. She also knows what it's like to be one of the most respected figures in American politics from at least her early days as Secretary of State. That's her choice. And she's having, you know, Chelsea's having a baby, and most people think that's a, what difference does that make? I don't know, you know, in terms of running for president. But every individual makes their own decisions. But to the point, if you think that Hillary Clinton didn't already know that it was going to be nuts if she runs for president, that they were going to, you know, not only throw the kitchen sink
point.
At her, but throw everybody else's kitchen sink at her. You know, they're going to rip kitchen sinks out of every house in America and throw them at her. But do you think she didn't know that?
Yeah.
You know, so that's the point. But I get what they're doing. They're trying to prove that we're tough. We'll be feisty if we take her on. But I think she's got that part figured out.
We're talking with John King, CNN's chief national correspondent. You know, one more thing on the Monica Lewinsky story. I've been rather stunned at this assumption in certain quarters that this would hurt her because it's...
Her being Hillary Clinton?
Hillary Clinton. First of all, because at the time Monica Lewinsky came out, Hillary's poll ratings, which had been shaky, shot through the roof because she got the empathy vote from many people who didn't like her that much. Women are a significant factor in the voting booth, particularly older women. I think to a lot of people, this is 20 years ago. You know, Bill and Hillary Clinton, who knows what goes on in that marriage, but they're still married. They're about to be grandparents. The idea that sort of thing would hurt her now, I don't get that thinking, John. What am I missing?
Look, I think, is it possible that there are some voters out there? You're exactly right, number one, that she got great sympathy after the Monica Lewinsky scandal. I was covering the White House in those days. A lot of people think it helped her to her win in the Senate race in New York State. You know, after the Clinton administration was winding down. Are there some voters out there who might be reminded that with the Clintons, I'm not picking sides here, but she's a serious, very deep policy person. You get a formidable person, somebody who loves policy. You get a credible person of huge gravitas if she runs for the presidency. You also get the circus. There's just no question about that. With the Clintons comes the circus. Are there some voters who would say, oh, God, I can't, you know, no, I don't want to do that? I think that's possible depending on who her opponent is. If you're torn 50-50 between Hillary Clinton and whoever her opponent is, and you know you're legitimately torn 50-50, well then maybe. But how many of those voters are there? I think it's a small slice. I think most of the people who don't want the Clinton circus already weren't going to vote for Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
I do think there's a tiny group of people out there, but again, it always depends on who you're running against. We have these conversations about any candidate, whether it's for dog catcher or president of the United States. But guess what? You know, it's hard to make judgments until you know who else is on the ballot.
John, can we continue the Hillary Clinton hour for just one more second here? Or maybe it's not the Hillary Clinton hour. You mentioned Benghazi a couple of minutes ago. We all know there's a House Select Committee on Benghazi, which has been set up. Yet another set of hearings. Last I heard, and I haven't looked this morning or the last 24 hours, Democrats were considering whether they'd even participate in this exercise. What's the latest thinking, pro and con? Where is that?
My understanding on this is that Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic leader, wants to meet one-on-one with Speaker John Boehner to see if they can work this out, and that meeting has not been scheduled. That when it was first raised as a possibility, Speaker Boehner's response was, let's see if the staffs can work it out so that the committee works to your liking. And the Democrats say, well, that simply hasn't happened. Republicans have more members on the committee. You know, if you have more members and you have the chair, Democrats want co-chairs. They want, you know, a Democrat, Trey Gowdy, is the Republican chairman of this new select committee. The Democrats want an equal Democrat who can, you know, has equal power.
Yeah.
The Republicans say, no, we have the majority. There have been select committees in the past that have operated that way or something close to that. Will they be able to work this out? I'm highly doubtful. But I'm told that Leader Pelosi wants a face-to-face one-on-one with Speaker Boehner, and that hasn't happened. And so I think we're going to wait a little bit to get the final decision. Risky for the Democrats. You know, I get the politics of boycotting. You can say it's a show trial, essentially. You know, the Republicans are raising money off this, and they're not interested in facts. They're just interested in a partisan enterprise. And a lot of Democrats would cheer them if they walked away. But, you know, the administration has also failed the transparency test on Benghazi a few times. So if during this investigation, Republicans did find some new witness, or the administration, which has withheld documents in the past, suddenly turned over new documents, and they were having a serious conversation, well, if there's no Democrats in the room, that could be trouble.
So you do, I was, just to make clear that you weren't intimating, you're saying specifically there are still some questions that a legitimate inquiry could and should address about Benghazi.
You know, I don't know the answer to that, but I have said and taken heat from Democrats for about a year now, just saying that if you look at the history of this administration, which says we've turned over everything, and then the week after that, they say, oh, we found this. And then 2 months after that, they say, oh, we found this. And just last week or 2 weeks ago now, you know, a conservative group, Judicial Watch, has to go to court. And then they turn over more documents that the State Department acknowledges, even though Jay Carney says they're not. The State Department acknowledges in a letter to Congress were directly covered by a subpoena issued months ago. I'm sorry. You know, I know the partisan Democrats out there are throwing things at the radio. But this administration has not performed in a surrender all the documents way, in a way where they can say completely to the Republicans, we gave you everything, go away. You know, because there have been dribble, court cases, other subpoenas to get documents. And so because the administration was not fully forthcoming at the beginning, they've given the Republicans that platform to say, well, maybe they're hiding something else. Are they? I have no idea. I certainly hope not. But the administration has opened itself to this criticism.
We're talking with John King from CNN. Let's move on to our former governor, Mitt Romney, former presidential candidate, of course. He said last week that he supports raising the federal minimum wage to $10.10. He said this right after the Senate rejected a bill. We've got a piece of sound. He was on Morning Joe last week on MSNBC talking about this. Here it is.
I, for instance, as you know, part company with many of the conservatives in my party on the issue of the minimum wage. I think we ought to raise it because, frankly, our party is all about more jobs and better pay.
So what's is this about a change in the Republican establishment, John King? Mitt Romney says he's not running for president. I don't know. Maybe it's about that, too. What do you make of it?
It's not the first time he has said that, but that still doesn't mean it's not significant because of when he said it. Where the Republicans were in the middle of this conversation, and he was asked a question that had a number of policy issues in there, and he chose to specifically address the minimum wage one and saying, you know, I break from my party on this, trying to nudge some people in the party along to try to get some kind of a compromise on this. I think, and I hope I'm fair to Governor Romney in saying this, I don't think he supports the Democrats want to go to $10.10 an hour. If my memory is right, the Governor Romney doesn't support going that high. But does think the Democrats, the Republicans should make a compromise here. That's exactly the position George H.W. Bush took back when I first came to Washington. It was the first big story I covered. Ted Kennedy was the head of the Labor Committee then, and George H.W. Bush was president. And, you know, they fought like cats and dogs for close to a year, and then they cut a deal and raised the minimum wage back in 1989. It might have been early 1990, but I think they did it in 1989. And that's what Mitt Romney's trying to do. And look, you know, some people will say this is the ghost of the 47%, you know, nudging Mitt Romney along. But I think this has been his policy position for quite some time, that the minimum wage can be part of an economic strategy as long as you do other things to help create jobs and to deal with the wage inequality. So I said this about Hillary Clinton last week when she said something on guns, took a very clear specific position. I'll say the same thing to Governor Romney. I think all politicians who are clear about what they believe should be applauded because it helps us advance the debate. And that's a policy push. Will John Boehner say, oh, Mitt Romney wants me to raise the minimum wage, let's cut a deal? I think not. But there are a growing number. Rick Santorum, think about that race, right?
Yeah.
Rick Santorum ran on the same campaign as Mitt Romney. Rick Santorum says the Republicans should raise the minimum wage because they need to have, A, he says it's the right thing to do, and B, he says the politics will give us more credibility with, you know, downscale blue-collar workers. So there are a mix of Republicans who you wouldn't normally put on the same list who think this is a good idea. Will that come to some critical mass before the election? I don't think so. But it has stirred anew a debate within the Republican Party.
Well, let's ask the exact same question about a different topic, which we've asked you about only about 48 times. I think it was watching you at 7:30 this morning on CNN. Correct me if I'm wrong. It was you who were talking about the head of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce advocating yet again that immigration reform happen and happen now. It was you, right?
Yeah, it's Tom Donahue, the head of the president of the chamber, and they've wanted this for quite some time. And they support, they would take a path to citizenship for the undocumented. They would certainly support what many Republicans would prefer to do, which is the path to legal status short of citizenship. And what Tom Donahue said was if they don't do this, they should just not bother to run a candidate in the 2016 presidential election because you're not going to win. He's half joking. He's trying to get attention there. But if you look at the demographics, and we have talked about this, he's really not joking. You know, it's hard to see Nevada, New Mexico, Florida, even the state of Virginia has a growing Latino population that's a swing population. I could name three or four other. Arizona is becoming more and more of a battleground state. You know, the demographics say if the Republicans don't deal with their Latino crisis, stop running in national elections because we're wasting time and money. Will they do it this year? Again, Speaker Boehner's been debating himself on this issue for most of the year, and then when cornered by reporters, he blames the president. He says nobody trusts the president. The Republicans don't trust the president. I just don't see it happening before the election, but there are some people who think there's a sliver of hope that late, when we get closer to the fall, the House will do something. But then the question is, can they actually get the Senate to, you know, do reconciliation? Mm-hmm. I don't think so, but it's not completely dead. If you want to do a, you know, Monty Python line, it's not dead yet.
John King.
Some of my favorite political analysts, by the way, yeah. John Cleese and his friends.
You know what? If they can explain what's going on in Washington, how about that than I can?
So let's move out of Washington for a second, John, and talk about what's going on over in Nigeria with this Boko Haram horrible situation. More than 250 schoolgirls, as people know, were kidnapped back on April 14th. And the leader of this Boko Haram says he'll only release these young women in return for militant prisoners being freed. Meanwhile, the United States has sent military and law enforcement people over there to help look for these girls. So first, is there are we risking any kind of backlash if we don't find them? I mean, the United States is arriving, and what about negotiating?
I don't think there's a huge risk, you know, to the president. I mean, we've talked about his foreign policy of late. You know, is there some risk that he underestimated Putin? Is there some, you know, there's obviously a lot of criticism about the Middle East peace talks and criticism about Syria and criticism about Libya. I don't think there's, you know, I think most, there's been pretty bipartisan support for let's do what we can when it comes to these kidnapped girls. And at the moment, my understanding is they've sent over some, you know, law enforcement people to advise them, give them some consulting, and military surveillance, so some drones. And I heard our Barbara Starr at the Pentagon reporting some manned aircraft as well, doing surveillance to help them, you know, try to locate where are these, how many Boko Haram are there, what kind of an operation would it take, emphasis on would, conditional, if you were going to do some kind of a rescue. And then there's been this talk of maybe there'll be some kind of a negotiation for a prisoner swap. I think the administration, it took a while to get there, which for me, that's not a criticism of this administration. I'm always struck when, and this is one of the things Republicans say about Benghazi, is why did it take so long to get troops there? When they say at the State Department, we're sending a team, and then they tell you it'll get there in 10 days. Why does it take that long? But they are there. And I think, obviously, this administration and I know the Brits are involved and some other, trying to do everything they can to help. It's the governor of Nigeria's decision, first and foremost, to decide whether you're going to negotiate, and then we'll see what happens after that.
Speaking of negotiate, just for one last second here, John, virtually every Western government and Western supporting government says it doesn't negotiate with terrorists. And the best example of a government that says it doesn't that I can think of that does is our ally Israel, because obviously there have been lots of swaps of prisoners there. The United States is at the top of the heap saying we don't negotiate with terrorists. Is that real, or is that just what the public position's got to be? Because obviously, if you do negotiate with terrorists in a public sort of way, one could argue it's an incentive for them to do more horrible things because you'll negotiate with them again. So where's the reality here?
Well, I think if you look at, there have been conversations of bringing, not negotiations for, you know, the tit-for-tat deals, exchanges, at least that I'm aware of, but there have been, you know, times when the Taliban have come into conversations about the future of Afghanistan.
Yeah.
So there are exceptions to every rule, I guess is what I want to say. But I think, you know, that is the general principle. And then if you do have the exception, well, then what they always say is, well, this is about the political future. And, you know, the government of Afghanistan wants them to be there or needs them to be there because you can't cut a viable deal unless they're involved because of their influence. So there's a way to, I'm going to use the word rationalize, and I don't mean it to sound so negative, because sometimes you just can't solve a problem without bringing in the bad guy. That's just the fact of life.
Well, last thing, John, speaking of general principles, I have a feeling as a Dorchester kid, you'll agree with me on this. Is it not a general principle in your world that if you have the best turkey hash on the planet, you should never close your restaurant? Have you ever been to Charlie's Sandwich Shop that's closing in June?
Beautiful Columbus Avenue. Yes, I used to work. One of my many jobs in Boston was my sister was the general manager of a courier company that was tucked in off Mass Ave there behind where the meat market is and everything down in there. And I used to stop there sometimes for breakfast when I was working and occasionally for lunch when I was driving around. Luckily, I already got paid, so they can't find out I was loafing by getting a sandwich. But many moons ago. Look, great institutions in these cities. My dad was a guard at the Charles Street Jail, and we used to love when he forgot things and had to go back to work because we'd get to go to Riley's Roast Beef, you know, which is right next to the old jail. When the great institutions close down, number one, you get nostalgic like this and you have great memories. The problem is in July when you drive by there and it's not there anymore and it's closed, you get a little lump in your throat and you get hungry.
It really is horrible.
It is a great place. It does make you feel sad. We just got an email, by the way, from a neuropsychologist specializing in brain injury, John King, who says that glasses have got nothing to do with treatment for any kind of traumatic brain injury, so that Carl Rove doesn't know what he's talking about.
Carl Rove graduated from one of the finest medical schools in America, so he would know. Hey, John, it's great to talk to you, as always, and we'll speak to you soon.
John, go Bruins. Take care, guys.
We knew you'd slide that baby in. See you, John.
John King is CNN's chief national correspondent. Not only a big Red Sox fan, but a big Boston Bruins fan as well, and the host of Inside Politics every Sunday morning at 8:30. Up next, pay your tributes here to Charlie's Sandwich Shop. We were just talking about it with John King. It is closing after 87 years. What are you going to miss? The hash? The staff? Standing in line for hours on Sunday mornings? What else do you miss around Boston that's no longer here? That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browder. She is Marjorie. And we thought it was the end of an era when Anthony's Pier 4 closed. We thought it was an end of an era when Building 19 closed its doors. And we said it was an end of an era when the Hilltop Steakhouse closed earlier this year. It seems the era just can't get its fill of endings. Because now, as we just said to John King, the latest Boston institution to call it a day is Charlie's Sandwich Shop. After 87 years in business, they're closing next month for good. Everyone from Duke Ellington to Barack Obama is eating at Charlie's. Cops, robbers, pimps, prostitutes, and the city's political elite have all had a seat at the countertop over the years. And we want to know about you. Have you been there? Are you going to miss it? If you're going to miss it, you can pay your tributes, share recollections. And whether you miss it or not, what is the institution that you most miss that was here forever? Restaurant, supermarket, department store. What's the piece of historic Boston that is no more that you miss the most? Our number is 877-301-8970. I was only at Charlie's maybe 5 times ever. Had turkey hash because I love corned beef hash, and I had to try it the first time. It is legendary. In fact, I think their Twitter handle is Turkey Hash. I believe it is. It was spectacular. And also, you know what was great? And they make this point in the piece by Billy Baker in the Boston Globe. I think it was yesterday or was it today? The Charlie's Sandwich Shop, authentic to the last bite. Nothing has changed. I mean, I wasn't there 87 years ago.
There's no bathroom?
But I know.
I did not know that.
Believe me, I found it out when I was having lunch with a friend a couple of years ago, and it was a hard find beyond that. But everything is the same. I love that part of it. It wasn't just that the food was good. It's like a greasy spoon kind of deal in the best sense of the word.
But they had great. I love the griddle cakes. That was my thing there. The blueberry griddle cakes or the banana griddle cakes. They had French toast.
When was the most recent time you were there? How long was the most recent?
Oh my goodness, probably 4 years ago, maybe, because the Herald used to be in the South End, moved down to the waterfront. Yeah. So after it moved out of the South End, I was there less often. But you would go there a lot when you were out working on stories and stuff and stop in at Charlie's. It was always a great place to go. But the South End is so, so different now. I mean, the South End was always hard scrabble, as they say. It was always kind of a joke. You go down to the bank before everybody had ATMs to cash your check. And, you know, I remember one time having to actually dodge bullets as I walked down Harrison Avenue. It was the Wild West down there. But now it's very different. And I'm sure they're not going out of business because they've been pushed out of business. By the way, the owners have just been there forever and they've had enough. And the guy's 73 years old and he says he wants to retire and enjoy his retirement. And his kids aren't interested in the business. But the South End, I don't think it will be a Charlie's Sandwich Shop type place that replaces it.
And also the history is great, some of which I was not aware of. I'm reading this piece in the Globe today. You know that there were a lot of places that wouldn't serve blacks not so long ago, restaurants. And they write that black musicians, Duke Ellington, Cab Calloway, weren't permitted to eat at the clubs where they were playing, would go to Charlie's, which at that point was what I love, 24/7. 877. I know,
yeah.
Everything should be 24/7 as far as I'm concerned. 877-301-8970. Are you a Charlie's Sandwich Shop-ophile? Will you miss it? And again, whether you miss it or not, what's the thing that really is Boston to you that you can't, you really think about missing? I'll tell you what's the top of my list, and it's not very original. You know what it is.
Filene's Basement.
It was pretty fun. When I first moved to Boston in the mid to late 80s, that's where everybody said you had to go. You had to go to Faneuil Hall, and you had to go to Durgan Park, and you had to go to Filene's Basement. Filene's Basement was everything it was cracked up to be, and then some. Some of my proudest moments, I've told you this before, and actually I had this conversation with Tom Menino, who did the same thing when he was mayor. His favorite salesman, the same salesman, would always hide a suit for him that he picked the day before the final markdown, hide it in the wrong size. I would do that for myself, and the feeling of satisfaction when he came back the next day and a 44 extra long was still in the 38 shorts or whatever it was, and he got it. It had a great Boston kind of feel, and Charlie's Sandwich Shop clearly is in that category as well.
877-301-8970. I didn't know this until I read the story today.
What's that?
This is by a guy that wrote a book about Charlie's Sandwich Shop, this guy George Cuddy.
Yeah, he used to work there, by the way.
Yes, he used to work there. Said that Cadillac Frank Salemi, one of the famous guys that was hooked up with Whitey Bulger way back when, was a constant customer there and one of their nicest customers, apparently.
They didn't know who he was till they saw him on television, TV. One of the owners say. But isn't that the best part of this is that it was just you are who you are when you're in our restaurant, which is really a throwback, which I love. Let's go to Jay in a car. You are first as we reminisce about the soon-to-be-closed Charlie's Sandwich Shop. Hey there, Jay.
Hello, how are you? Can you hear me?
We can hear you perfectly. Thanks for the call.
Yes, I was just saying my professional career was really launched from Charlie's by, on the way going to UMass Boston, I used to stop there in the morning and have breakfast and meet with some friends, and it was way back in 1972. But later on in life, I have a business and I have a lot of employees, and one of my particular employees had cancer, and I would take her into Boston to her appointments. And she'd always say, "Can we go to Charlie's lunch for breakfast?" And I loved it because I wanted her to eat, you know, and stay healthy. Mm-hmm. And we just had a great time just reminiscing there. And it's just a great institution.
Well, those are great memories. Thanks for sharing them with us, Jay. That's great. 877-301-8970. You know what I love about these kinds of topics? You hear the smile in Jay's voice when he was speaking. I mean, you hear John King a couple of minutes ago lighting up, talking about his father, talking about his sister running a courier business in the neighborhood. I mean, that's the beauty of these great institutions that are so much, I mean, they really are Boston.
We're getting some great emails.
Like what?
Christopher says that he, despite all the benefits of the big dig in opening up the North End, he missed the elevated central artery and the views of the city. And you know, one thing about that, Christopher, and I'm with you, when you would drive through, now you're in a tunnel, so you don't see the city. When you drive through the central artery, they have the Beale Building with a great big red bow at Christmas time. I always kind of liked to look out the window, and you could also look out on the other side and see the Boston Harbor Hotel with that
the arch
that you could see the water through. So that was one. Mark said he's going to miss Lochober, the legendary restaurant down in the Financial District.
Speaking of that, by the way, what would I order at Lochober's? Not that you asked.
And turkey hash?
No, they didn't have turkey hash. They had this red corned beef or roast beef hash that was fabulous. Talk about it. Great. You know, and by the way, last time I was at Lochober, was that how many years ago to close? 5, 7, 8,
no,
9 years ago?
No, I think it's more recent.
Is it more recent than that? Maybe they reopened, I guess, and then closed again. And I assumed it was for historical purpose, a women's only entrance.
Yeah, that's right. It was a big stink.
Were you supposed to enter through contemporarily? Were you supposed to enter through that entrance, or was that just a throwback,
a
reminder?
It was a throwback because I went there like maybe 15 years ago. They had a big stink about the gentlemen's clubs, too. Remember that the women had to come in a different entrance? Bill just sent a great one, too. Said he missed Howard Johnson's. He didn't say if he missed the one in Kenmore Square, the one right outside of Boston, heading south on the way to Quincy. But remember there was a Howard Johnson there, too? He said
what was the best food at Howard Johnson's?
Well, he said he liked the cheeseburgers, but I don't remember the cheeseburgers.
Hot dog on a buttered square roll. Hello? Okay,
I think you have a photographic food memory.
No, I have a food. I do have it. The former president of the Hotel Workers Union is a good friend of mine, and he said I had a food memory. And I do. I have a food memory. I know where I ate and what I ate. Here's Charlie's co-owner, if I could pronounce his name, I would, talking about meeting the president when he went there just, I guess, about a year or so ago about closing the store. Here it is.
Obama came in June. And that was very exciting. He came in, and my wife was at the door, Geraldine, and she said, "We love you." He said, "I need a hug. Give me a hug." And she almost fainted. It's been a great run. And we're happy to leave on a high note. I'm in my 70s, and I want to walk out of here and not be carried away.
That was a great bite. I want to walk out of here and not be carried out. And I love when she says, my wife almost fainted when the president said, I need a hug. Give me a hug. How great is that? He was there campaigning for Ed Markey. That's why he was in town.
Remember,
they
must have had a bathroom. They just wouldn't open it to customers. You can't work all day long with no bathroom.
I was under the impression, maybe there's a grandparents clause. Someone may know this, will email us or call us. I thought if you had a food establishment.
I thought so too.
I thought you had to have a restaurant. But maybe if you existed prior to that regulation, you're allowed not to have a I don't know what the deal is, but the bottom line is they did not. 877-301-8970. You know, the frequency of this kind of topic for us, an institution closing, is growing in intensity. I mean, a lot of big – how long ago did Hilltop close? 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, whatever it was, wasn't that long ago.
You know what I miss?
What?
Even though the food hadn't been the best in the last few years, I miss Jimmy's Harborside because you could go out there in the summertime and sit in the back porch by the water and eat that Velveeta cheese, you know, and have a drink. And I miss Jimmy's Harborside. It's so chic down there in the South Border.
Well, but you have to say, sitting on the upper deck at Legal is about as beautiful a spot in Boston.
It's a beautiful spot, but it's like a total mob scene.
It is a mob scene.
And the average age is 21.
By the way, Pawan tweets us and says, I miss the Wonder Bread Factory in Natick. Oh, the smell.
That's a great
point.
That's
what they do. That is
Let's
great.
Go to Suzanne from the South End, where Charlie's Sandwich Shop is located.
Hey,
Hi,
Suzanne.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Great. Well, I'm a fairly newcomer to the South End, but I think that Charlie's is just wonderful, and it is an institution, and it's going to be greatly missed, and I think it would be superb if the space was made into a South End museum.
That is a great idea.
There is so much history here and so many people who have lived almost their whole lives, or at least their whole adult lives here, and they have so many stories, and that would just be a perfect place to keep those memoirs.
Suzanne, what did you order when you went in?
What did I order? I usually go for breakfast, so it's usually eggs and veggies and bacon.
Yeah, you know, especially because of the racial history, too, where it was one of the few places, and one of these stories mentions that Sammy Davis used to tap dance outside the place
great.
When he was in performing in town. The fact that all these legendary musicians, like Duke Ellington, couldn't eat at the place he was playing would come there. And the pictures, there's a million pictures on the wall there. I can't remember who's on the pictures, but there's a million of them.
There's a great little piece, by the way, just mentioning the president before, and you heard the owner commenting on it. He ordered this is according to the Globe story. He got a cheeseburger with lettuce, tomato, and mustard and French fries. The combo is now known on the menu as the Obama burger. And he got some ribbing from Marie Fuller, one of the siblings who runs the place. She teased the president about what the famously health-conscious first lady would think of his lunch. But actually, she wouldn't be upset. What's the name of the joint that just opened Shake Shack?
Yeah.
Isn't that her favorite place in Washington?
I think she sneaks in some burgers
and fries.
So
she occasionally
does
that too, yeah.
Robin and Lowell, what do you think about Charlie's Sandwich Shop or other places in Boston you'll miss?
Hi guys. I'm Audrey.
Hi,
Robin.
Well, don't hate me. I've never been there. I've lived in Boston about 12 years.
It's okay.
And I would really love for you guys to recommend what to order if I were to stop by there now. So I lived in JP, so I used to hang in a lot of restaurants out that way when I first moved to Boston. The place I miss is Bob's Fleet Stationery in Cambridge.
So do I. My older daughter worked there during her gap year between high school and college. What a great place. Describe it, Robin.
I used to walk in and, you know, all the notebooks were there, all the artists' drawing supplies, all the beautiful little cards, you know, the independent, you know, they produced cards, just beautiful, and just wander around and look at all the pens and pencils. And I like to write. I do memoir journaling, and I would always buy my journals there and, you know, bring them home and, you know, just love the whole feel of the store. And the staff was always so gracious and laid back.
Well, you know, it's interesting.
Just go and just be in that space.
Well, it did have a great feeling. By the way, it's reopened one location, but it's under new ownership. And, you know, when my kids started working there, I guess, as I said, during her gap year, I said, is it fun to use one of the questions? Is it fun to use the scanner? And she said, oh, we don't have a scanner. Everything was a throwback. If you bought 100 pens, you couldn't slide them through the scanner. You had to look at the tag on every single pen and type it. And while it took more time, a la Charlie's Sandwich Shop, it was a throwback to another era. It was
Why
so
did it
fabulous.
Close?
I can't remember. There were two brothers, if I recall, who owned it. There were two or three slates in Cambridge, again, one of which is reopened under new ownership. It was, again, an institution, but I assume the staples of the world can beat it in terms of price and volume, and I'm guessing that's what led to its demise. I don't know. 877-301-8970. We're using the impending closing of Charlie's Sandwich Shop to talk about both your memories of Charlie's and other institutions that have gone the way of Charlie's.
Amanda emails that her mother used to bribe the kids with Bailey's Sundays if we behaved ourselves at Finley's Basin. Remember Bailey's?
I do.
Ooh, the dripping hot fudge, she says. We got another email from the Bush or the Bushy or whatever, missing Building 19. Gosh, remember going down there and trying to get the really cheap oriental rugs? That was
one of the foulest places on the planet. But by the way, it was fun, but it was really
grotesque.
Do you know
about Ray's Sub Shop in Leechmere Square? The best submarines ever? Well, Ellen, I think this is the famous Ellen that you know from, anyway, that she loved Ray's Sub Shop in Leechmere Square.
877-301-8970 is our phone number. Let's go to Cass. You're in the car. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Cass.
Glad to speak with you.
And you too.
Radio show in Boston by far.
Couldn't agree with you more. Thank you, Cass.
That's right. You're absolutely right.
Go ahead, Cass. Sorry.
Three things. There was a Howard Johnson's on Tremont Street, almost at Boylston. That may have been one of the first in Boston.
Gosh, I don't remember that.
Yeah, I used to go there with my father, and it's many, many decades ago. The second thing is I wholeheartedly agree. Feline's Basement made me one of the best-dressed college students in Boston. I frequented it with relish all the time.
Yeah.
And thirdly, I remember Walkovers because it was the first restaurant my husband took me to on a date.
Those are good reason to remember. Do you remember, didn't all the waiters in Lockovers, I think even to the end, didn't they all wear gloves? Am I right about that, or is that an apocryphal tale? I think that's true.
You know, I was so enthralled with my husband that I don't remember the gloves.
I'm sure we would have been, too. Hey, Cass, thank you for a great call, and thanks for your kind words.
Did you ever go to the dining room at the old Ritz-Carlton upstairs?
Oh, sure.
Where the waiters would all get dressed up, and I don't know if they were tuxedos, but they almost looked like it, and they would bring out your food. Food was never very good for some reason, but they'd bring it out in these huge silver
where you pull the top off, like on television. I know, I remember that.
Yeah, so you didn't care that it tasted terrible. And then you look over the public garden, which is gorgeous. That was really neat. That's gone now, too. Oh, my God, Jim, everything's gone.
No, it is not. Everything is not gone. Let's go to Barbara in Lexington, because she's going to mention one of my favorite places of all time that I haven't thought about in years. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks.
That lady was wrong. You're not the best radio station in Cambridge. You're the best radio station in the country.
Well, okay.
There you go.
That may be a bit much, Barbara, but
why not? Embrace it, Jim.
Okay, so what do you miss, Barbara?
I miss Elsie's in Harvard Square.
Oh, the best sandwich shop for the cheapest prices. There's a little ATM there, which is so depressing. It's unbelievable.
Horrible.
What'd you used to order?
Burgers, but they mixed like relish with ketchup and mustard. Sounds awful. It was delicious.
The other places
that I missed is the No Name. Remember the No Name down by...
Is the No Name gone? The fish restaurant on the...
I didn't know that.
In South Boston? It is?
And thirdly, it was Betty's Rolls Royce.
Yeah, I'm not sure. We can check, by the way. I don't think No Name is gone. And if it is, it disappeared without Marjorie or me knowing about it. But we'll check it out for you, Barbara, and thanks. Elsie's was... You know what Elsie's was? Another throwback kind of place. Prices were throwback. The staff were throwback. It was sort of a la Charlie's Sandwich Shop.
Mary Beth misses the Brigham Stores. Kelly misses the Seymour Ice Cream Company in Dorchester.
I don't remember that.
But boy, I have a favorite ice cream place down the Cape. But if it ever closed, I'd be
devastated. What's it called? Four Corners or something?
Four Seas.
Well, you know, it's also
fantastic.
Great.
Fantastic. I don't even like ice cream.
Hasn't Necco's just moved somewhere else? Because I've told you, if you go to Main Street in Cambridge, yeah. Where it's just where the Necco Factory used to be, even if you didn't like Necco wafers, and I think most people couldn't stand them. I actually loved them, particularly licorice. The smell lingers. How many years ago did that close on Main Street in Cambridge? 5, 10, 15, I don't know what it was. You can still smell the sweetness in the air. I'm sure it's all toxic, but it is. No, I'm serious, but it is a great, smell.
Okay, let's go to Linda in Beverly. Hi, Linda.
Hey, Linda.
You're talking chocolate. Oh, my God, Shrapps and... in Childstown.
Oh, Shrapps,
yes. One of the best places, and it was way before you came to Boston, Jim.
Yeah.
But the best deli around was Essex Deli on the corner of Essex and Washington Street downtown.
Oh, I never even heard of it.
And what happened? Because Boston doesn't really have a good deli. Jim is always complaining.
Well, good Jewish deli. It has some good Italian delis.
Jewish deli. It was awesome. And it was right there, you know, at the beginning of the theater district. But with, redevelopment and everything else, it went its way. But it had been around for ages. And I think it closed in the late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah, it's long.
That was awesome.
There was another
breakfast place called Mondo's that was over near Quincy Market before they, roastified Quincy Market. And that opened at 2 o'clock in the morning. You'd go after you closed all the dance places. You'd go there, and they closed at 7 o'clock in the morning. They're only open for 5 hours.
Well, by the way, speaking of breakfast places, when I lived in New York and when I lived here, there's that great, was it Blue Diner or whatever it's called, down on Neyland Street, I guess it is. Is there anything better, Linda, than an all-night diner? Whatever you're doing, you're working, you're dancing, whatever you're doing, at 2 a.m. to go out for breakfast. Does it get any better than that?
It never gets any better.
Linda, thanks for your call. We appreciate it.
Let's bring this back to Charlie's Sandwich Shop. Jonathan just emails and says he lived down near the South End for much of the 80s and used to eat at Charlie's a lot. And one morning he asked the waitress how they made their hot oatmeal taste so creamy. And she said they serve their oatmeal with real cream.
That's your kind of thing.
Oh, my God.
This is a woman who makes mashed potatoes with heavy cream. Is that accurate,
well,
Marjorie?
Well, there's nothing like butter and cream, Jim, I always say. Okay. Thank you for that. That was a great segment. Up next, it is a story that involves a Rubik's Cube, a hotel room barricaded with pillows, and a $300 TV set. What does this have to do with the NSA and the huge reach of today's government surveillance? It all comes together in a new Frontline documentary. We're going to hear all about it up next on 89.7 WGBH. Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're going to let President Obama kick off our next conversation. Here he is last week at the White House Press Correspondents' Dinner.
Speaking of Rand Paul, Colorado legalized marijuana this year, an interesting social experiment. I do hope it doesn't lead to a whole lot of paranoid people who think that the federal government's out to get them and listening to their phone calls. That would be a problem.
Talk about truth in jest for a lot of people, from former NSA employees to whistleblowers like Edward Snowden and New York Times reporter James Risen, who was with us a couple of months ago. The NSA is hardly a laughing matter. Here with us in Studio 3 to talk about how extensive and expansive the NSA surveillance program has become since 9/11 is Michael Kirk. Michael's the director, writer, and producer of the new Frontline documentary, which is both thrilling and frightening. The United States of Secrets, Part 1, airs tonight. Michael, good to see you again.
Thanks, Jim. Nice to be here.
Michael, thank you so much for coming in.
Hi.
Excuse me. As I said before, by the time I finished your spectacular documentary, I was enraged at everybody, George Bush, Barack Obama, the FBI, the overweening, scary, frightening power of the federal government. You start and end with Edward Snowden, but a lot of your documentary is about the lives of very good public servants basically being devastated. So tell people what the thesis is. What's your this documentary about?
Once upon a time, there was an agency in the United States of America that had spied on Americans and got its fingers slapped for doing it in the 1970s. The rule of thumb, the great bright white line at the agency, which was unbelievably powerful in its ability to surveil, eavesdrop, and wiretap, was never turn those eyes and ears towards Americans. And the people who worked there, patriotic, hardworking, good American sort of pocket protector kind of scientists, believed that line, believed it. And then this thing called 9/11 happened. And almost as fast as – faster than you can imagine – the rules were changed, the lines were blurred, and the government, the National Security Agency, turned all of that power on the American people. And the people who did the turning, the scientists, those pocket protector people, witnessed it, and many, many of them worried a lot about it and talked to us.
Yeah, speaking of the pocket protector people, it's so perfect. Here is former NSA employee Wiebe and journalist James Bamford on how the NSA actually learned about 9/11. Listen to this.
Oh, my goodness, there is smoke pouring out of the Pentagon.
Everybody had the TV on because the TV is where the news was. It wasn't coming out of NSA's computers. It was on the TV because we had missed the entire event.
Quickly coming down.
This is a live picture. We are seeing...
Oh, my God.
It was an enormous shock that you have this huge agency set up to prevent a surprise attack, and they learn about it on a $300 television set tuned to CNN in the director's office.
It's almost perfect because we've seen the NSA building. We've been introduced by you and your colleagues, Michael, to the massive amounts of data that's being collected, and it's on CNN that they learn about this thing.
They missed it entirely, you guys. And when they went back 3 days later and started to look, they discovered that some of the terrorists, some of the guys who hijackers who took the planes, were staying in a motel right in the shadow of the NSA out in Fort Meade in Maryland, that they went to an ATM, not a 10-minute drive from the NSA, that they had actual intercepts, the NSA, on its vast data reservoirs that said the game's on, tonight's the night, all of that, and they had missed it all because, of course, they had all the data. They weren't supposed to have some of it. They didn't know that part of those conversations were happening in San Diego and Washington. And I think the regret and guilt inside the NSA on those first couple of days was palpable and really phenomenal and contributed to what happened over the next day.
And by the way, it was Keystone Cops-like, but which and the natural inclination, which I'm glad to hear, is we have to figure out how to do this better. But the problem, as you lay out in a couple of hours, is better wasn't just the rule. Broader and, in many cases, unconstitutional was the rule.
Well, when you talk, Michael, about the terrible guilt and regret some of these NSA people felt, we have an NSA engineer here, Edward Loomis, who's describing that had the NSA operated differently, 9/11 could have been prevented. Let's hear from Ed Loomis.
I do believe it could have been prevented with revisions to the way we were permitted to operate before 9/11. Revisions that I tried to get the general counsel to embrace and couldn't. I tried to get them to make adjustments to how we were operating, how we were permitted to operate, and they wouldn't do it. I felt this ever since it occurred, that over 3,000 people's lives were lost, and it's just a weight that I have been having trouble bearing.
Michael, before we get to the NSA spying on everybody, which is what they eventually ended up doing, he seemed to be talking about a middle ground where there might have been something between having no idea, learning about this on television, and where we eventually went. Was he correct about that? Was there a middle ground?
Yes, of course. Many people at the NSA, the scientists working there, knew in the 90s, as the agency itself was becoming moribund, the Cold War was over, we weren't interested in spending lots of money on spy things around the world. We didn't yet know that there was a threat coming from a group called Al-Qaeda. At least we didn't recognize how big the threat was. But the guys working there, watching Silicon Valley grow, said, hey, wait a minute, we're behind the curve here. And they went to work on a program called Thin Thread, which was very straightforward, kind of an elegant solution. Essentially what it would do was grab people in this big kind of dragnet network setup, kind of like Facebook, find them, encrypt the ones that were in America, because they knew that because many of the internet hubs are running through the United States, they might as well, this is the place to go to get it. But the law seemed to preclude them from knowing about Americans, so they encrypted the data, anonymizing the American portions of it. Unless they heard something, a safe house in Yemen calling a house in San Diego, then they could go to the FISA court, a special secret court inside the Justice Department, and say to them, we need a warrant so we can listen to and explore how many phone calls were from Yemen to this number and who from this number in San Diego. Where did they call else in the United States? And we can find people. We can create, in three hops, they can create several million people who are connected to a phone call in Yemen. But and they knew that they could do that, but they had to create a thing that was a system that was relatively inexpensive, very elegant in its ability to capture lots of people, and anonymizing Americans so that they could do it in the United States. They thought they had it, but the NSA, nervous at the time about crossing that line into American spying, wouldn't let them go.
I have to say I've never heard the verb anonymizing before, but I love it. It says it all.
It's a term of art.
So all of a sudden, there were a bunch of people in powerful positions, Mike Kirk, who decided that anonymizing, encrypting the names of Americans, unless essentially there's probable cause, which is what the Constitution says.
Right.
You get some information, you have probable cause, you go get a warrant. They decided that wasn't enough. And what then happened?
What happens is that Thin Thread becomes a piece of a much larger, quicker idea. The vice president calls George Tenet at the CIA. Tenet calls Mike Hayden, who runs the NSA. And Tenet says to Hayden, hey, the vice president and David Addington, his top lawyer and aide, want to do something, realize we have to do something we have never done before, which is we've really got to stretch this out. We've got to turn it aggressively on the bad guys around the world and in the United States, because they were worried about sleeper cells. Remember, we all thought, oh, my God, they're everywhere. So Tenet says to Hayden, what can you do? Be thinking big stuff. And Hayden, the head of the NSA, says, no, I can't do it, not within my existing authorities. And Tenet says to him, that's not the question I ask. He said, what could you do? So Hayden comes to his staff at the NSA and he says, take the gloves off, the familiar phrase that was also used at the CIA, and said, bring me an aggressive plan. They did. And the aggressive plan turned out to be thin thread without the anonymizing and, in other words, without the encryption of all the American stuff and a lot more. So in order to go find the bad guys, the few bad guys that were out there, what they decided to do was capture information on everybody all over the world.
You know, a lot of people were criticized during the Bush presidency for belittling him by saying, oh, he wasn't the president. The president was Dick Cheney. When you watch the United States of Secrets, you realize for these purposes, it was President Cheney. Memos, critical memos, were not drafted as they ordinarily would be by the White House counsel, the Department of Justice, but by this David Addington for the vice president. And finally, when the president of the United States is told about some of these things by concerned great public servants, it's pretty clear to me, and I assume that this is the impression we were to get, Michael, he had no idea what was going on about a lot of the stuff that Cheney and Addington were running through the government. That's a fair description, yes?
Yeah, I think this film is the first time, you know, I've been doing a version of this story for 10 years, and lots of films about Iraq and the Iraq War and the webs of mass destruction and all of that, spying and torture. And this is the first time we managed to get Alberto Gonzalez, who was his chief lawyer, the president's chief lawyer, eventually becomes attorney general, and Andy Card, who was the chief of staff. So we can triangulate what was going in and what was coming out.
And a Massachusetts guy, by the way, a former state rep. We've spoken to him a number of times.
Exactly, yeah. and an otherwise fine citizen, except for the work that he did and didn't do on behalf of bringing the president the information that he might have needed about the existence of this program, the thing we call the program, which is the massive spying, metadata capturing, everything about telephones and internet. So the president didn't know. We're certain of that from both what Gonzalez told us and what Andy Card told us, until the very, very end, when about a half a dozen people at the Justice Department and the head of the FBI, Bob Mueller, are threatening to resign if the program isn't, or a portion of the program isn't, turned off. And the president looks at Jim Comey and Mueller in a secret meeting, two secret meetings inside the White House, and says, why didn't you bring this information to me earlier? And Comey says to him, this is the acting attorney general, says to him, if you didn't know about this for the last 3 months, you're being poorly served by the people close to you, which would also be Card and whatever. What it really means is that the vice president and David Addington were running the show.
We're talking to Michael Kirk, who's the man behind United States of Secrets. You can see it tonight. It's a Frontline production. You can see it tonight on PBS.
Well, one of the few encouraging things as an American, I mean, you did a great job, but it was very depressing watching this. But one of the encouraging things was the bravery of a lot of these bureaucrats and people within the NSA who knew that it was wrong to be doing this level of surveillance and tried to do something. Tell us about some of these people.
There's the group around the thin thread. We call them the thin thread group. It's the guy who started it, a crypto mathematician named Bill Binney. There's a guy named Kirk Wiebe. There's Ed Loomis, who we've already heard. They were all working to try to inside the organization, following the rules. These are rule followers, these guys, 40 years in the government, former military, a lot of them, trying to get the government to pay the inside bureaucracy of the NSA to pay attention and not do what they consider to be illegal activity. When the NSA bosses wouldn't listen to them, they then took it to a woman named Diane Rourke, who's this amazing figure, a Senate staffer in the House Intelligence Committee, worked for Porter Goss, very powerful person.
Talk about a patriot, by the way, but go right ahead.
She's great. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, you mean Porter or Diane?
Well, I'm talking about Diane Rourke.
Yeah. Amazing. Amazing. And she as they say in television, jumps off the screen. She's just spectacularly a powerful force that said, wait a minute, and did everything she could with the Thin Thread group inside the government, not going to the press, not breaking any of the rules, inside the government to get it changed. But, of course, the importance of the secret from Cheney, Addington, Hayden, Tenet, all of Gonzalez, all of them was so critical to the existence of it. It had to be a secret. I mean, in many ways, that's what the film is about, what kind of secrets we'll try to keep. As they say, it's never the crime, it's always the cover-up. And in this case, it was the idea of it didn't even exist, and that had to be the way they all played it. Well, Diane and the Thin Thread group were trying to break it, and another guy named Tom Drake, who was a very high-ranking person there, stayed inside. The others left the government. Tom stayed inside, Mr. Drake, and tried to push it. And the following of all of their journey, trying to do what many of us outside would call the right thing, in the face of the force of this government protecting its deepest, darkest secret, something they've had for, you know, years and years and years and cannot let it go out under the penalty of all kinds of things, including potential felonies that they were committing, breaking the FISA law of the 1970s. Those people, in the face of that kind of forced pushback from the government, did what many people who like the idea of leaking and whistleblowing believe is the most courageous thing that somebody's done in the government in a long, long time.
You know, long before the Edward Snowden and the Guardian and the Washington Post, a story we learn in the documentary almost ran in the New York Times right before the reelection campaign of George Bush. It was spiked by the executive editor, Keller, and later James Risen, who spent some time with us recently, who was the reporter, one of the reporters in the case, decides to write a book, and then all of a sudden the pressure is on the New York Times to act like the New York Times. So the Baltimore Sun gets something. The New York Times' hand is forced. They print something, and all of a sudden, rather than going after the illegality at the top of government, they decide to go after the leakers. And one of my favorite lines, Michael Kirk, in this whole thing is, I think he's then the Attorney General, Gonzalez, says they broke the law. The DOJ, Department of Justice, goes after those who broke the law, meaning the leakers, not the people who are violating the Constitution. And they not only go after these people, most of whom are lifers who have spent the pocket protector types, as you say, loving this country, loving the NSA. Listen to this account from United States of Secrets, of the lengths the FBI went to track down NSA employees who were leakers within the government. Listen to this.
At 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, the FBI, with guns drawn, raids the homes of Binney and Wiebe. And out on the West Coast, they raid the home of Diane Broek, waking her up.
It was quite shocking. And in fact, they went through the whole house and went through every book, every paper, every drawer, turned the mattress over, you know. It was quite shocking.
It's 9 o'clock in the morning, and I see these blue uniform with gold FBI on the back people coming across left to right, and I said, well, it sent a chill through me immediately.
Well, the first I knew the FBI was in my house was the guy pointing a gun at me when I was coming out of the shower.
You know, you laugh when you hear this.
But this is unbelievable. It's just so frightening that they're like thugs, these guys from the FBI. And then tell us what happened to Thomas Drake, one of the other people that was involved and stayed and chose to stay in the government.
They hit Drake about 6 months after they hit the others. They take all of his stuff out of his basement. They take computers. They take other things. And they pull him in. He uses all of his retirement savings. He mortgages his house. He literally, whenever the government, if the ton of bricks fall on you by the government and they want you to flip, the money it costs you, I mean, it's astonishing for people who don't know what happens. You step up, the price you pay if the FBI decides to put you in its gun sights, literally in some cases, is profound. What they were obviously trying to get Drake to do was say that he or the other groups, the other people of the Thin Thread group, one of them or all of them had spoken to James Risen and Erich Litblau from the New York Times. So they were after the leak, and in return for that, or as part of that, what they decided to do was make the pressure so intense on Drake that he would flip and give somebody up or something up. Drake didn't really have anything to give up. He hadn't done anything, and the Thin Thread Group hadn't done anything. As Risen tells us in the film, they'd never actually done anything. But what the pressure that was brought on him was pretty phenomenal all the way down till the just, I think, the day or the couple of days before he was supposed to go to trial for espionage.
Facing years and years and years.
Facing 35 years in prison.
Yeah.
The federal prosecutor had said to him, Mr. Drake, you're screwed. We're going to, and when Drake wouldn't flip, he said, this is according to Drake, he said, well, then we'll go with what we have. And what they had was documents that they found in Drake's basement that said he was, that they said were classified documents. So he has classified documents in his basement. They have no proof that he ever met or saw anybody at the New York Times, and they have no proof that he distributed those documents, but they have those documents, which he's not supposed to have in his possession. So what does his defense do? The defense, which is by then a public defender, asks Jim Bamford, the writer of Puzzle Palace and lots of other great books about the NSA, asks Bamford, hires him, and says, look at the documents and see if these things or really should be classified. And Bamford goes on the web and finds them available, readily available on the web as unclassified documents, and the government had put them there. So what they discover, what the attorneys discover, is that the government had pulled the unclassified documents out of his basement, decided that they should have been classified documents, drew a line through the unclassified part of it and said, these are classified documents, but of top secret documents. Of course, they weren't. The case fell apart. Drake was fined $25 and given a year's community service. But in return, of course, he ended up losing not only his career at the NSA, not only his life savings, not only his retirement, but he now works in a mall in Maryland at an Apple store at the Genius Bar.
You know, it's what we're talking to Michael Kirk,
unbelievable,
who is the man behind United States of Secrets. You can see tonight, Frontline on PBS. You know, Marjorie mentioned the heroes, a word is so overused. But in this case, these I don't know, mid to high level staffers at NSA who had the courage to essentially defend the Constitution. You come out of this. Congress was pathetic. Bill Keller at the New York Times, embarrassing. Barack Obama campaigns, and you have great sound from no more secrecy. Everything will be done with a warrant. And listen to this just for a second to give you one further headache. Here's the Richard Clark, who became pretty famous in America, New York Times reporter Peter Baker and Washington Post Barton Gellman on President Obama's decision to keep President Bush's NSA program intact.
When you get into office, when you're the man, when you're in the White House, you don't want to give up any tools that you inherit. You don't want to give up anything that might get you that one fact that will stop an attack.
He made his decision. The program would continue.
He had a chance to say, well, that's too far. Let's not sweep in quite so many people who don't have anything to do with terrorism as part of this broad sweep. And he chose to keep the programs largely intact.
I'm not aware of any case in which Obama pushed back hard and said, you can't do that.
You know, the end of the story, to me, Michael Kirk, is every time Congress, in a rare moment of strength, asks the White House, well, tell us an attack you prevented as a result of this broad sweep, either unconstitutional according to many, closely so to others, they still haven't been able to come up with one example of anything that's been thwarted by this massive intrusion into the private lives of Americans, have they?
No, and in fact, the president's commission that he named with five of his closest associates, former associates, who were looking into the program, including Dick Clark, they called themselves the Five Guys, looking closely at what had happened with the program. Of the 46 things they recommended to change that had to be done to the president, he ignored a tremendous number of them. One of the things was, to me, the most surprising thing was that they said that the telephone records process, which is an unbelievably huge thing, yielded no results whatsoever. That, and I think, you know, you can probably extrapolate. If they, believe me, I think if they had, Mike Hayden is willing to talk about enough things, mm-hmm, that if they had a great example,
they'd be telling us about it.
It seemed like we'd know that it was better than the Brooklyn Bridge burn down that they were threatening.
One last quick thing from me, Michael Kirk. What do you think of James Snowden, who, of course, is in exile? Edward Snowden, who is in exile now for turning over all these documents to
I think it's one of those questions a lot of people ask me, and it's the hero or traitor dichotomy in some ways. And I always dodge the question and say, watch the film and you tell me what you think of Edward Snowden. What I know about him was this was a completely thought through thing. I don't know of another whistleblower that literally took a job so that they could grab all the documents he grabbed. I think he watched what happened to the whistleblowers we've been talking about. All those stories that broke in 2005 and early 2006. All those stories didn't have any paper attached to them, really. They had a little bit of this or that. But as we all know in the news business, it didn't have legs. It really didn't. We thought, well, the privacy isn't palpable, invasion isn't palpable enough, whatever. What Snowden decided to do was he not only needed some paper, he needed a lot of paper. And he needed to distribute it to people who would actually distribute it. So he kept it intentionally away from the New York Times and gave it to Bart Gellman at the Washington Post or Laura Poitras, the filmmaker, or Glenn Greenwald, the blogger.
Because he was disgusted with how the New York Times had dealt with the story prior to the election by spiking it.
Precisely. And all big media, for that matter. I mean, he just believed all big media is in the pocket of the White House, and he has plenty of proof to show it after watching it for all these years. So Snowden was very controlled about that. What he didn't plan was what to do once he'd released it. And he didn't. And it's amazing that a guy who thinks it through at that level then finds himself hidden in the streets of Hong Kong, in China, of all places, and no escape plan anyplace else. I think that amazes Gellman and Greenwald and others, and Laura, the others that we've talked to about this. Hero or traitor, I mean, I think you watch it and you decide.
Yeah, let me tell you, you watch it for just one last piece of review. Every single key player on all sides of this, other than this David Addington from Cheney's office, everyone's here. And when you see the faces, and I think you'd agree, Marjorie, of the men and women who have had the courage to stand up to their government to protect all the rest, it is so moving. Yeah. Michael Kirk is brilliant.
Congratulations.
Thank you for your time.
A really fantastic job. Michael Kirk is the writer, director, and producer of the very upsetting new Frontline documentary, The United States of Secrets, Part 1, airs tonight. Check your local PBS stations for listings. You can catch Part 2 next Tuesday. Michael, again, thank you for joining us, and
Thanks.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Up next, we're going to ask you about government surveillance. After hearing the liberties that our government has taken when it comes to spying on United States citizens, are you outraged or have you just kind of checked out? We're taking your calls next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, we are speaking with Michael Kirk about his new Frontline documentary, United States of Secrets, which is this incredible, chilling, in-depth look at how the NSA surveillance program has expanded since 9/11. And that, of course, includes listening in and reading in on you. So do you care about your privacy rights being compromised, that your constitutional rights are apparently being exploited by your own government, and that people who tried to protect you were persecuted and or in some cases prosecuted? Our number is 877-301-8970. I was looking at some polls from the Pew Research Center this morning, Marjorie.
Yep.
While a slim majority of people don't support the NSA program anymore, this shift really came after Edward Snowden, Snowden's disclosures. You don't get the sense, at least I don't get the sense, that there's any passion about this. Tea Partiers and a few liberals have numbers in the 60s where they think this is outrageous. For the most part, I think people say the right thing when they're asked the question by a pollster. I don't think protecting our privacy rights from our own government is a high priority for anybody. And by the way, if you're in that category, all I advise you do is check your PBS listings, watch this Frontline documentary tonight, and trust me, you will feel differently after those 2 hours. This is, as I said, a chilling situation. As I said to Michael Kirk, when the Attorney General of the United States at the time, Alberto Gonzalez, talks about going after those who broke the law, and what he means is honorable, patriotic, decent lifers within the NSA who were only attempting to protect us from unconstitutional violations of our rights to privacy. He goes after them when he is surrounded by clearly unconstitutional behavior by people at the top reaches of government.
Well, that's the part that drives me absolutely insane. I mean, I don't think most of us like to be spied on by anybody, but to see the unbelievable power of the federal government coming down on people, ruining their livelihoods, cost them to spend all their money on lawyers, basically going bankrupt. And then the FBI, and we've talked a lot about the FBI in Massachusetts here when it comes to the Whitey Bulger case, when it comes to the Marathon bombing case. Here's a little clip about the FBI, the lengths they went to track down those NSA leakers who were within the government.
At 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, the FBI, with guns drawn, raids the homes of Binney and Wiebe. And out on the West Coast, they raid the home of Diane Rourke, waking her up.
It was quite shocking. And in fact, they went through the whole house and went through every book, every paper, every drawer, turned the mattress over, you know. It was quite shocking.
It's 9 o'clock in the morning, and I see these blue uniform with gold FBI on the back people coming across left to right. And I said, well, it sent a chill through me immediately.
Well, at first I knew the FBI was in my house was the guy pointing a gun at me when I was coming out of the shower.
Again, these are people who had worked for the government, some of them their whole lives for decades, many of whom had not done any leaking, by the way, some of whom admittedly have, but only after they went to all their superiors and said, we're violating the Constitution, and all of them said, move
Patriots.
On.
Patriots, I would say. Yeah. The one that sticks out in my mind, too, is this Thomas Drake fellow who wound up spending all his savings and all his money on lawyers' fees to defend
lost
themselves.
Lost his wife.
Yeah, lost his wife, and now he's working in an Apple store. And there's no recompense. There's no listen, we're sorry. He ended up pleading guilty to some minor misdemeanor.
Do you know why he's working in an Apple store and why they got away with this? Because the American people don't care. Because the notion is, and it's not as bad as it was immediately after 9/11, and I understand it then, that we'd have to compromise some of our personal privacy rights for the greater good of security. But as we said to Michael Kirk, when people in the administration are asked to point to even one example of a terrorist attack being thwarted by this massive intrusive collection of data, they come up with on. And as he said, if they did have one, obviously they'd be trumpeting this. And you know what the other part that upsets me that the American people are, in my opinion, so unupset about this is we were lied to. You know, it's one thing if you say, I'm fine with this. If you're fine with this, you're fine with it. If you're fine with them having the right without a warrant to go into your phone records, to go into your email, if that's okay with you, you're entitled to have that position. You are not entitled, in my opinion, to believe it's okay to have the president the United States say that there is no such program when in fact there is. And then you hear in this film, and I'll stop ranting and we'll take your calls at 877-301-8970. The goal here is, oh, well, at least they should be seeking a warrant from the FISA court. Now, maybe that's better than warrantless searches, but the FISA court, this is a year old, what I'm about to say, so it may have changed. Every single request the government ever made for a warrant to the secret court, every one was granted except for one. That one the government took up on appeal, and that was granted. Meaning, yes, it is true that there's a court that approves these warrants, but they rubber stamp everything the government does. But at least in that case, they complied with the law under this Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court, whatever.
General rule, secret courts, secret government proceedings, all this secrecy stuff, all this stuff that's classified that doesn't need to be classified, it never ends well, Jim.
Do you think I'm right? Do you think I'm right about where the average American is on this? The Tea Partiers are crazy about it. Liberal Democrats are crazy about it, but that's it.
I think there's a certain sense. You know, 30 years ago when you kept your papers in some locked safe somewhere or the safety deposit box, whatever, it was one thing. Today, everybody's privacy is all over the place online. I think there's a little bit of a difference attitude about it because they know where you are on your cell phone. They know where you are on your GPS. They can go your cell phone, your emails, all these things.
Do you remember the government guest we had the other day? Who was in studio with us? Do you remember? Secretary of Transportation.
Oh, yes, Rich Davey.
And I said to Rich Davey, what is wrong with our fellow Massachusetts citizens who've decided that they will not get Easy Pass and as a result are willing to line up at a toll booth for 10 minutes while the rest of us are speeding through? Well, they're willing to stand. And his response was, you know, they don't want to essentially intruding in their lives, getting their personal data. People are willing to stand up to the Department of Transportation's collection of data, which is virtually nil, on an Easy Pass, but they are not willing to stand up and be counted about this massive collection of data on all of us by our government. And we haven't done anything wrong.
And I think the other lesson here is, like I said, the government's ability to ruin lives and just ruin lives of good people and just say, hey, them's the brakes and walks away. It reminds me, now I'll shut up and we'll take the phone calls, but it reminds me of these stories you see every few years about the IRS making examples of certain people who've, you know, they're behind in their taxes or something, storming in, taking their homes, taking everything, just doing these horrible things. And okay, they made a mistake in their taxes or they were late 2 years or something. This is supposed to be, we're not supposed to be under the thumb of the government. It almost makes me want to be a Tea Party or myself when I see some of these stories about the power they wield without any apology. And these people are just left on the side of the road like roadkill.
That's because of us, because we don't complain. 877-301-8970 is our number.
Let's go to Dan from Worcester. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Dan.
Hi, Marjorie and Jim.
Hi.
You just said it all, Marjorie. This horse is out of the barn, and everybody's running around and trying to push the gate closed now. Computers, cell phones, the IRS, credit cards, anything you do now, everything. I mean, I had lunch today, and I wanted this cell phone, and I used the credit card. Already the IRS knows that I had a turkey sandwich, where, how much I paid for it, and if I'm going to be able to write it off on my taxes next
year. Yeah, but Dan, let me tell you, I shouldn't get into this. I think you had too much mayo on that thing. At least that was the sense I got.
We were watching you, Dan.
So, Dan, is your position, agreeing with Marjorie, that we're just, is the place you're going is, listen, we are so used to being, quote, spied on or at least surveilled every single direction that we've become basically immune to up anger about it. Is that where you are?
Well, I shouldn't, Jim, not exactly. I mean, I know I'm smart enough to know where I am in the world and what's going on, but I'm not happy about it. And I'm not a Tea Party member, okay? You know that I'm a conservative person.
Yeah, we do, sure.
From my conversations, but I'm not a Tea Party guy. But you know what, Marjorie, you just said it again. It makes you wonder.
Yeah.
Should you join the Tea Party? Should you think something of like the Tea Party to say, hey, wait a minute. This is enough. When do we stop this stuff, and how do we go about stopping it?
Hey, Dan, beautifully put. Thank you, as always, for your fine call.
Well, there's no accountability. There's no sense that they have to explain the government what they did to us. We're just kind of like chumps.
Well, you know why? Because the ultimate chumps was the government. When you look at one of the most poignant scenes, you really have to watch this tonight. We really recommend something, both of us, this strongly. This Diane Rourke, who is a staff person to a key congressional committee, she's in total angst about this because she is the most law-abiding, patriotic citizen. And when she finally goes to her boss, who's chair of the Intelligence Committee, what does she find out? He knew about it all along. And essentially, every time someone in the administration sold them a bill of goods about this, they rubber stamped everything. And we shouldn't leave Barack Obama out of this. Barack Obama campaigned, as was very clear in this film, for the end of secrecy, railed against these programs. He not only voted for them in one of his final acts as United States Senator, but he's continued virtually all of those which he decried when he was a candidate for president and when he was a senator from Illinois.
Well, you know, that was one of the other lessons of this whole thing, too. Whoever said in this film that when you become the man, as in the president of the United States, when all the responsibility rests with you, you're very loath to give up anything that might give a terrorist or somebody else a little bit of an edge. But you sort of need people to be a little bit more courageous.
Yeah, but you know what they're worried about? Remember in the film they keep saying what President Bush's final tactic always was, if everything didn't work in these meetings, if there's another attack, the blood's going to be on your hands. When you're a president, I'm not defending Barack Obama, I think I'm explaining it, is you say to yourself, if there's an attack in the future, and the attack was because I decided it was more important to protect the privacy rights of my fellow Americans, am I the one who's going to bear the brunt of criticism for letting down our
guard. Well, you are the one that's going to bear the brunt of criticism.
Which is why they probably don't do it.
Right, but I guess if you feel – if that is your core belief, to use an overused phrase, if that's what Obama really believed when he was running for president –
He should have said it.
Well, I think so.
Can I tell you something?
What?
I believe he did believe it when he was running, that it wasn't a scam. I don't have any inside information. And all of a sudden, you're getting those briefings every single morning, the security briefings, and you're all of a sudden confronted with the security apparatus and infrastructure – And this is where you end up. Let's go on the road with Jim. You are next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Jim.
Hi, Jim Montrez. Good to hear you guys all the time.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, I think we got to wake up and get moving. And maybe we need to form a new party. You know, like you were saying earlier about those are true patriots. And I think sometimes in this country, we have a very distorted idea of what it means to be patriotic. And
Amen.
I think the people you're talking about are true patriots, and maybe that's the kind of party we need to start, is one that really looks at the best, hope for the best intentions of our
society. All you have to do if you want to start that party, Jim, instead of going to the NSA, you have to go see that guy, former NSA employee, whose life was ruined at the Genius Bar at an Apple store. You know, we laugh about it. That's what happened to this guy. Life totally and completely destroyed
and
by the government.
And the other
Jim,
thing is,
thank you.
People with the worst they were is leakers, if they were even leakers. Guns drawn when you're coming out of the shower. What is wrong with knocking on the door and saying we're out here? You go in, the kid in the house lets them into the house, mm-hmm. the teenage son that's home or something, and they're waiting for this guy while he's drying off on his towel in
the
bathroom.
Well, how about the same guy that
like
you're talking?
Like he was a mafioso that killed 20 people. Of course, the mafioso that did kill 20 people.
They're out of jail and collecting Social Security.
Exactly.
In Cambridge.
Exactly.
You know, the other thing here, which should be touched on, and Michael Kirk did this with us and has done brilliantly in the documentary, which you find hard to believe until you actually see the document on the screen. They arrested this Drake character after they seized his computers,
right,
saying that he had unauthorized access, unauthorized possession of classified documents.
That's correct.
And that researcher proved, one, that none of them were classified, that they were all in the public domain. And then what did they do? They crossed out the line on the thing that said unclassified and wrote in after the fact that they were classified in an attempt to nail this guy.
Well, and once again, the FBI is in the middle of this whole thing. I mean, somebody needs to do a big investigation of the FBI. Who's going to do the investigation of the FBI?
The same guy who did the investigation of the Totoshev shooting in Florida. That's the guy who's going to do it. Let's go to Chris. You're in a car. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Thank you much for your call. Hi.
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 I got to say, I couldn't disagree with you guys more. I think you're being incredibly naive, and I almost think you're kind of overselling the narrative, because it's a lot sexier and easier to sell the prospect that, oh, we all have to worry about these macro bits of data that they know how to sift through. Do you realize your credit card company can tell 3 months before it happens whether or not you're about to get divorced?
Well, Chris, no, I read that. Chris, we've actually discussed that on the show, but let me interrupt you to respond to the naivete. My Visa card is not able to listen in on a telephone conversation I have with you. Well, you, they can, because you're on the air, Marjorie Egan. They can't read my email. I haven't done anything wrong. And by the way, if they have probable cause to believe that I've done something to harm my country or that I am planning to do something to harm my country, then they should go to that FISA court in secret, get a warrant, and come to my house and break the door down. But until I have, I believe that I have the protection of the Constitution. So with all due respect, if I may, I would argue the naivete is on your end.
Let me ask you something.
Sure.
How would you feel if you sent a friend an email to her Gmail account, and minutes later, based on the content, I mean the content of what I sent to her in that email, I got back an ad precisely about the thing that I was discussing. If you think that your details of your email are in any way, shape, or form private, and that's the private sector that's doing that, that's not the government, I'm telling you, you're naive in that you're thinking that they're sitting out there collecting the content of your conversations willy-nilly and then turning around and using that for something.
Okay, so Chris, let me respond to what you say one more time, and I do respect your point of view, and you're probably right about the Visa thing. Here's the one difference, I think, and like your quick response to this. I chose to have a Visa card. I didn't authorize the government to both lie to me, as is evidence in this film, and collect this data on me, this very, very open, unencrypted data. Don't you think that's a reasonable distinction?
Just like in any marketing where they sift down, they drill down based on specific pieces of data, they're able to very quickly eliminate the stuff that is of absolutely no interest or use to them. That's the vast majority of conversations that you or I are having on our
show. No, but that's, Chris, we finally found something where you were, could not be more dead wrong. Every single analyst of this huge amount of data they're collecting, everyone, right, left, and middle, says the biggest problem, even if you don't care about the constitutionality issue, is they know how to collect it. They have absolutely no idea how to use it. That's what they focused on, is massive collection, but not analysis. Chris, thank you for the call, though. We do appreciate your point of view.
One of the things that Kirk said yesterday when he was talking about a couple of the 9/11 terrorists that live right down the street from the NSA offices or something like that. I mean, it was just incredible. They missed that completely. And that's
Go back to the first thing. I thought where you were going is that in terms of what Chris was just saying, and it was a good call about their use of the data, the great line we played from the documentary where the guy at the NSA itself said they learned about the 9/11 bombings not from their own internal information collection, yep. But how did they learn about
it? On the TV.
CNN.
On the TV news. Yeah, well, that was, you know, that's why the NSA came into being, as this documentary reminds everybody, to prevent another, like, World War II. And, of course, as we all know, looking backwards on 9/11, there was a lot of warning from Osama bin Laden, and we just didn't heat it. 877-301-8970. Yes, Jim?
Let me just say one last thing about this. Whether you're on the side of Chris, who called a second ago, who said essentially that we're naive, that everybody and every contact we have has huge amount of intimate data on it, so the genie is out of the bottle.
We do.
Or if you subscribe to the Jim and Marjorie school on this particular thing, watch this tonight. And if you can't watch it tonight, DVR it and watch it in the future. Even if you don't care about the surveillance, trust me, you're going to care as much as Marjorie has expressed about these people who essentially gave up their work lives in an attempt to protect all of us from this
well,
intrusion.
Well, as I said, I'm like a broken record on this. It's the accountability that we never get.
That's true.
I shouldn't say never. That we
rarely get.
Very often do not get from the government when the government has done something bad that they don't want us to know about. They cover it up. It's classified. It's secret. We're protecting people's privacy rights. And 99% of the time, they're protecting their own ineptitude and mistakes and sometimes law-breaking as well. Chris in Weymouth. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Marjorie. Jim. Great show.
Hey there.
I just had a little story. I'm a Vietnam veteran. Back in the 70s, when I got out of Vietnam in 1970, the data wasn't there. Even in Vietnam, the data wasn't there. But today, they collect everything about everything. They do. I have a friend of mine that works in the NSA, okay, and he tells me things, not off the record, but he says, they collect everything about everyone and everything.
Well, you learn that. We learned this when we watched it over the weekend. They collect everything, about everybody. Chris, thank you for the call.
Chris, we are out of time, so we've got to move on. But it's a very unnerving documentary, and it's a great documentary. You should check it out. Up next, we're going to look at another government intervention. That was the big bank bailout of 2008. Former Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner recalls the financial meltdown in a new book. Does his take on how he handles it square with Harvard historian Nancy Kane's analysis? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Subprime loans, credit default swaps, toxic assets, too big to fail. That was the word cloud hovering over the nation when Tim Geithner took over in 2009 as Treasury Secretary. The word cloud hovering over the country today is, I don't know, 1% versus the 99%, student loan debt, wealth gap. So did Geithner save the nation from total financial ruin? He has his own take in his new memoir, Stress Test, and Harvard historian Nancy Kane joins us for hers. Nancy, as you know, is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Hello there, Nancy.
Hello, Nancy. So how much did he get right, Nancy Kane, Timothy Geithner, the former Treasury Secretary?
So, you know, his new book, is Geithner's book, Stress Test, has just literally been released yesterday. And I haven't read it.
Okay.
Forgive you. Forgive me. So I'm speaking from a series of lengthy interviews and reviews of this, all from the New York Times. Two of them by their Wall Street Deal book editor and writer, Andrew Ross Sorkin, and one by their kind of first-rate world-class book reviewer, Michiko Kakutani. And, you know, it sounds like a very balanced, very careful, and you know, it's not a tell-all book. It's careful, it's balanced, and you read these reviews. I'm going to read the book. As soon as I finish Thomas Piketty's book, I'm almost finished.
Everyone's talking about that, aren't
they? Oh, what a fabulous book.
History, Income, Inequality.
So I will just say as an aside, for those of our listeners that are interested in very good economic books, and Geithner's may or may not fit in that category, I don't know yet. Piketty's does, and it's eminently readable. And I was surprised by that. It's very readable. It's almost conversational, and yet you can tell it's from someone who's thought very deeply and is very knowledgeable, so you have great confidence in him, as you would like a beloved, knowledgeable teacher. Anyway,
Capital in the 21st Century.
Capital in the 21st right. Century is the title, full stop. Destined to be, I think, an extremely important book. And not unrelated to what Geithner's doing, which is trying to tell now that he's out of office, and from the gist of these interviews that he did with Mr. Sorkin, joyfully so. And he was ready to go. He and his wife wanted for him to be out of office. I think he was tired. I think it was hard work. I think they were just ready to move to a different stage in their life. And so I think this is his chance to, if you will, wrap it up with a bow. What did we do? How did it feel? Right? The opening line of the book review is, you know, what was it like to be at the eye of a financial storm? And, you know, one of the very interesting things about this book is that Geithner, like Henry Paulson, then Secretary of Treasury under George W. Bush, and Ben Bernanke, then head of the Fed, were there not just in September of 2008 when Lehman Brothers imploded, which is the date we customarily think of the very beginning of this drama. They were there all through 2007 and 2008 when lots and lots and lots of warning signs or dominoes were accumulating and falling. So, you know, it's very interesting to hear him talk to Sorkin about what it appeared like, which is we knew we were in deep trouble. The world economy was in deep trouble. And we didn't know, you know, in some cases, moment by moment, exactly what to do. The last point, the animating, if you will, I think, unstated but still very, very important thesis of the book is, if we hadn't done what we did, much worse would have followed. So that is, you know, we made up as we went along. We knew it was a really dangerous situation, and but for our actions, much worse would have followed. And, you know, whether readers and pundits and critics and politicians, you know, think that is a substantial and kind of, you know, sufficient explanation and justification for what would become the Obama administration's policies toward the fallout from the financial crisis, you know, is an open question. I think for Geithner, it really was the main highway. It was the major chord of the symphony. And that's probably true for Bernanke, too. We didn't know what was going to happen, but it looked like it was going to be really bad. And so we had to, in some sense, you know, use what tools we saw at the moment as being at our disposal.
Yeah, so, for example, one of the things that we had no choice but to do under Tim Geithner was give $200 billion in bailouts to AIG
right.
and stand by and say nothing while the executives whose company had gotten $200 billion of our money gave themselves $200 million, whatever, in bonuses. You know, the reason I think, in my estimation, everyone's set the record straight. I haven't read it yet either. I'll trust your analysis once you have read it, and then I'll read what you tell me to. Is if you were to say the name Tim Geithner, you did like a concept association game,
yep.
Honest to God, I would say three things. One, I would say he was picked to run the Treasury and in turn the IRS when he hadn't paid his taxes. That's the first thing everybody in America knew about Tim Geithner. Number two, he gave, and to his credit in the book, he admits the worst speech in the history of his department.
Sent the Dow Jones falling 500 points.
Here's a little piece, which doesn't sound so bad. This is February 2009. And this is when this is an attempted explanation of the rollout of the Save the Economy plan of Barack Obama. Just listen to a little bit of what Geithner had to say.
Let me describe each of these three steps. First, we're going to require banking institutions to go through a carefully designed, comprehensive stress test. This borrows the medical term. We want their balance sheets cleaner and stronger, and we're going to help this process by providing a new program of capital support for those institutions that need it.
Okay, most Americans have no idea what capital support is. They don't know what a stress test is in a financial setting.
They know he sounded like voice, he was about 12.
And his voice cracked. To his credit, he says in the book that it was one of the worst speeches. He didn't practice on the teleprompter, that sort of thing. And the third thing we remember about, at least I do, is the AIG thing. So I know you haven't read it. You just read analysis from people you trust. Do you get the sense that this is, here's my explanation after the fact of why I did the right thing, even though I will admit a few mistakes along the way, or do you get the sense that it's an honest retelling of what the administration did? And many critics believe what they did was far more favored Wall Street, as the old tired saying goes, than Main Street.
I suspect it's the latter. I suspect that Geithner really, you know, this is all of these books. You know, they're political in nature. They have to be, right? But they're also about, you know, here's my footprint on the history of the moment, right? I'm putting my footprint down on this ground. But they're also, remember, I know this as a writer, I know this as a historian, I can't say I know it as a silverback gorilla like Geithner or Bernanke or Alan Blinder or, you know, Henry Paulson, all of whom have written books, or Michael Lewis, right, who's a different kind of silverback gorilla, who wrote, really now has written two books recently on the financial industry, Flash Boys, his most recent one on high-speed trading, and The Big Short, which has to do with credit default swaps, which were bets that were part of the falling dominoes of the crisis, very important ethically, financially, and politically. In any event, they're always, all these people are also coming to terms with themselves at some level about what they did.
Right,
so,
of course.
Right? So, you know, it doesn't have the confidentiality and the Hippocratic Oath of your therapist's office, right? And you haven't met your maker, so you're not kind of facing the real truth. But, you know, this is partly about what did I do at some fundamental level, just like, you know, every memoir.
When you said his maker, did you mean God or Larry Summers? Who are you talking
well,
about?
That's a good question. Or Bob Rubin, right? All of them are important in the making of Tim Geithner. All of them have, and this to me is the most interesting thing about the book. I'll come back to the maker in a second. Rubin, Summers, right? Bob Rubin, Larry Summers, Tim Geithner. All of them were part of the prologue to this story. Now, the prologue matters a great deal. The prologue is is what happened between, say, 1996 and 2003 or 4 around government regulation in the financial system. And there were a whole host of deregulations and decisions, not just actions taken that lifted the reins of government oversight, including most famously the repeal of Glass-Steagall, which was a very important piece of New Deal legislation. Remember, the analog to all this, the comparison, is Roosevelt and the New Dealers and Bernanke, Paulson, and Geithner and the Great Recession, all of whom are comparing it to the Great Depression. So Bernanke, to a lesser extent, Summers, Rubin, Geithner, all in different ways part of a series of actions that literally lift the reins of regulation. They're also part of a series of policymakers. Remember, Geithner had never worked in banking. As much as he seems to have, you know, kind of at least a fear of confronting Wall Street, and he never worked in banking. He's gone into now private equity work for Warburg Pincus, where he's going to make a gazillion dollars, but that's not necessarily part of the story. It's just interesting. He never worked on Wall Street, but he and these other folks decide we won't regulate things like derivatives. A derivative, for all our listeners, is a financial product that is a product, some kind of combination or restructuring. It's part of what we call structured finance, restructuring kind of instrument of the financial markets that allows buyers and sellers of financial products, usually financial paper, to do different things. So, for example, what we call subprime debt or collateralized debt obligations is in effect a kind of derivative. Or credit default swaps, which literally were bets on whether a bundled package of subprime mortgages, right? Those are loans to housing buyers that have poor credit ratings, bundled together, supposedly in thoughtful, good ways that make this bundle less risky than any single one of those mortgages would be. Those were in the bets that were placed on them in the form of something called credit default swaps. I bet that bundle, you know, Goldman Sachs is actually going to go bad, and someone else buys a, in a sense, sells that to you, saying, "I bet it won't." Right? Literally, Just to put the record straight, at one point in 2007, there were $62.5 trillion worth of credit default swaps, completely unregulated. There is no reporting requirement, and this is a derivative on these financial instruments. So, and by the way, $62.5 trillion is about what household net worth was in the middle of 2007, just to give you a benchmark.
Wow.
So these men were part of a series of policy decisions, including decisions to do nothing about huge, fast-acting, fast-developing financial innovations on Wall Street and all over the
world.
So
the men essentially who were charged with fixing the problem
helped create the problem. They're not helped create. This isn't a government. As Lewis writes so well and lots of other very balanced people, it's not just about government. It's about a whole bunch of mostly male silverbacks on Wall Street and on Main Street selling loans to people. Mortgages that have no business getting loans, right? It's about all kinds of folks in the middle brokering those packages of loans and selling off to Wall Street. And let's not forget the credit rating agencies. For those of us that don't remember their names, Moody, Standard & Poor, and Fitch's. These were people that the SEC had designated to say what is a AAA asset. Remember, a lot of institutional investors like pension funds, like CalPERS, the California Pension State Pension Employees Fund, can't invest in anything that's below a certain grade. Well, who designates whether that bundle of mortgages is a below-grade investment bundle or an above-grade? Moody's, Standard & Poor's, and Fitch's. There's just a small rub here. Moody's, Standard & Poor, and Fitch's all get paid by the same banks that are issuing the securities, right, that are in these bundles. So there's just a wee conflict of interest.
Sounds
here
like the FISA court to me.
With me. So the point is that we have a drama. It's a Shakespearean drama. It involves, to a real extent, you know, people who had no business and knew they had no business buying mortgages. It involves a bunch of people along the value chain making money on those mortgages. It involves Wall Street, which in some sense at some huge high level knew that the banks, they themselves were too big to fail, so would take incredible risks. By the way, Goldman Sachs knew as early 2007 that all this stuff was crap, all this debt that they were, and they were shorting it. They were betting that its price would fall even as they were selling it to institutional investors, right? And Lloyd Blankfein's defense of that is we have very knowledgeable institutional investors.
And the reason Nancy just pointed me when she said Lloyd Blankfein, head of Goldman Sachs, invited, despite what happened here, to the first state dinner by the president of the United States.
So one last comment. So no one's. This is a complicated drama,
yeah,
but I've mentioned the biggest players. So to me,
well, you also have one person you haven't mentioned who he. I wouldn't say he exhibits contempt for, but clearly no love for, is a woman who actually believes in government regulation and those sort of things, our own Elizabeth Warren. She is not portrayed in a wonderful way in this book by Geithner.
No, and he's, you know, sorry. So anyone that's in the position he's in, right, where they're part of the prologue, and you got to think about the meetings he has with himself about that, right? He, Summers, others. The meetings they have with themselves about how they get right about that. So, you know, big mistake. Right. So he's part of the prologue. Then he and Hank Paulson and Summers and a few other, well, particularly Hank Paulson and Ben Bernanke, are sitting here as the world that they know and that we all depend on all over the globe, you know, faces a kind of Armageddon. And so an insider's view of that, I think, in itself makes a reason to at least pick up the book. And there's clearly, right, that kind of perspective that at least the first, you know, 40% of the book is, you know, the fall of 2008.
Well, you know, there's a section in this book where he talks about comparing the emotions he had. He wasn't obviously a soldier, to the Hurt Locker, and how he was so worried about catastrophic failure.
Yeah.
And the Hurt Locker, people remember, is when the guys were going up to defuse the bombs,
how he
thought it could have just ended in complete and utter failure. So it hasn't at least ended in complete and utter failure.
No, not at all. And I think that's very important. Right? Again, I start off with my adjective was balanced, right? This is too complicated a story to fit in one dark or all-white folder, folks. Whatever you think about Geithner, whatever you think about, you know, Wall Street, it's too complicated. We all depend on Wall Street, incidentally. So, but one of the interesting things, right, is that they think about it. Let's recall. I remember standing at HBS watching the Dow Jones fall on my computer the day that what was the beginnings of the financial bailout plan failed, and the Dow falls 700 points in a couple of hours. We thought the world was going to end. And what these guys were trying to do at some very fundamental level is, and it felt like that, was stop that. So let's not forget it.
I'm out of breath.
I don't know what any of this stuff means, of the swaps and the derivatives.
You know my favorite part we didn't get to? I was afraid she was going to ask us. You know my favorite part is he'd walk into a meeting with Larry Summers, who was advising the president, and say, is this a real meeting or a fake meeting? My favorite part. Nancy, great to see you.
Okay. Nancy joins us every Tuesday for Open Mic. She's an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book, Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Nancy, as always, that was great. And it was great for you guys to tune in for another edition of Boston Public Radio tomorrow. Medical ethicist Art Kaplan and the Boston Globe's Brian McGrory. Our show's a production of WGBH. Chelsea Murrah's Will Rose of Amanda McGowan, John Parker. Our team, I am Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thanks again for tuning in. Please tune in again tomorrow.